Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book that takes a deeper look at some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. This week's guest is Travis Vogan, Assistant Professor of American Studies at the University of Iowa. We're discussing Travis's book, Keeper of the Flame, NFL Films and the Rise of Sports Media, published by the University of Illinois Press in 2014. As someone who grew up watching the productions of NFL films, I really enjoyed this book. Travis discusses the people who made the films, in particular the father and son team of Ed and Steve Sable, and he looks at the ideas behind the productions. Travis looks at these productions as films, as well as promotions for the rising National Football League. And he makes the convincing argument that NFL films change the way that sports are presented. The book is well-researched and engagingly written, and it was a pleasure to talk with Travis about his work. Here's our interview. This week's guest on New Books in Sports is Travis Vogan. Travis, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So we start each podcast with a few words of background about our guests. So I'll ask you to tell us what led to your interest in sports and media in terms of studying sports and media. And in particular, what was the genesis of this project on NFL films?
Well, I always liked sports, and but I wasn't really studying sports initially when I started graduate school. I was in an English department, and then I went into a media studies department. I was primarily interested in documentary film, nonfiction media. And it occurred to me that there was an awful lot going on in sports that was really relevant to some of the issues that I was talking about more through kind of a humanistic and media studies lens. And I was surprised that there just wasn't much said about these things in a kind of scholarly register. And so I started investigating some of these issues just in coursework, kind of superficially and sort of for fun. I'd read a paper on them here and there. And one of the things that I was really interested in regards to documentary is some of the documentaries that would be sort of kind of strange or offbeat or would use sort of innovative practices. And I would always think of NFL films as a real interesting example of this and a provocative one because they were sort of right in the center of popular culture, whereas a lot of the documentaries that are a little more inventive tend to be kind of peripheral art films and whatnot. And so I thought it would be just kind of interesting to take a look at NFL films. And I wound up doing a little bit of research on them, and I just discovered that there was so much there, not only in terms of the documentaries themselves, but their relationship to pro football, and not to mention the kind of strange history of the company starting as an independent production company and then becoming this like sort of corporate propaganda arm, and sort of its evolution over the years alongside the rise of cable television and then the sort of proliferation of media that happens now with the rise of the internet and social media. And so I thought this would be an interesting dissertation topic, and so I wound up writing my dissertation on it with a lot of help from the folks at NFL Films, actually, who let me interview a good chunk of their staff and let me use their archive and access their archives. And the dissertation worked pretty well, and so I decided I was going to revise it into a book. And so over the course of the last few years, I've been transitioning out of the dissertation and revising it into a book and then going through the process. So that's kind of how it started.
And you mentioned the research that you did at NFL Films. I wanted to ask about that because they pretty much gave you open access, correct?
Yeah, they did. This was totally unusual. I was working on an initial project with NFL Films, and one of my professors at the time recommended that I get in touch with them. And I'd grown up watching these programs on TV and to my mind, Steve Sable, the former president of NFL Films, was, you know, he was a major celebrity. So I didn't think that he was, this is not actually the case, but in my mind he was. And I didn't think they would be really interested in giving me any kind of audience. And the NFL, as probably a lot of listeners know, has a kind of tight-lipped reputation. They call them the no-fun league, and they're very kind of cautious with their brand. So I wasn't expecting anything beyond maybe a fact sheet or, you know, sort of deferring me to PR or whatever. But I was on the phone with Steve Sable within 48 hours, I think. And he said, oh, you have to talk to this person, you have to talk to that person. And he hooked me up with all these other folks who had been there since the 70s and basically gave me an open invitation to go to NFL Films and do interviews and to access their archives and introduce me to a lot of the folks in NFL Films who run certain things that I didn't really know too much about. And they were incredibly accommodating. It was a really pleasant surprise.
And so how many hours of film did you end up watching?
I don't know. No, I have no idea. A lot. A lot of it is available on VHS. Kind of interesting because it's available in the archive, but there was this real wave of VHS in the mid 80s and early 90s. And a lot of that stuff will probably never be released on any other format unless they open up their archives to kind of a streaming service or something like that. So I just, I don't know how much I watched, but quite a lot.
Okay. Well, Travis, let's turn to your book, and I want to ask first about the title, Keepers of the Flame. And there's a story behind that phrase that you talk about in the book, and it gets at the connection of NFL Films to the National Football League. So could you talk about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. The title is their company motto. They adopted this motto from the Chicago Bears owner, George Halas. But he wasn't always particularly happy about NFL Films. He thought they were kind of a nuisance, and he thought that the league sent NFL Films cameras to spy on him and his team and his staff. And he was really kind of annoyed by these guys who were all of a sudden hanging out on the sidelines with 16-millimeter cameras at every game. And he eventually saw some of their programs and saw a few of their films about the Bears in particular, and he noticed that they were treating the league with such reverence and making it seem so dramatic and kind of amplifying its grandeur and all that kind of stuff that he was really kind of touched by. And he wrote this able a letter, and he referred to their company, which at that point was a subsidiary of the league, as the Keepers of the Flame for the NFL, something that would kind of maintain and uphold this positive mythology that has been so central to kind of selling the league since the 1960s. So that's where the title comes from.
So you mentioned Steve Sable, whom you met, but we should talk about his father, who was the founder of NFL Films, Ed Sable. So can you give us an introduction to Ed Sable and tell us about the origins of NFL Films?
Sure. Yeah, Big Ed, as they called him. He was an athlete growing up. He was on the swim team at Ohio State University. And he was also an actor and kind of a ham, actually. And he left Ohio State early to try his hand at Broadway. And he was in a few minor productions and didn't totally work out for him. And he wound up getting married and working for an overcoat company that his father-in-law owned. It's called the Jacob Siegel Coat Factory outside of Philadelphia. And he hated his job. He was just, he thought it was terrible and life sucking and all that kind of stuff. He described it several times as kind of like going to the dentist every day. And one of his real hobbies, though, when he was doing all of this stuff, when he was just, going about his workday life, was making home movies. And he would do it kind of obsessively. He would make movies of of everything. Steve Sable once said that, you know, and Steve Sable is very quotable too, that he didn't know his dad had a head when he was growing up because the camera was always on his shoulder. So he took it seriously, and he would make all kinds of films, and he would edit them together, and actually pretty sophisticated amateur filmmaker. And so after a while, his father-in-law, I think he was probably about 40, early 40s at the time, his father-in-law decided they were going to sell the business. And so Sable got a pretty big windfall of cash, and he decided that he was just going to kind of retire early and hang out and make movies and travel around. And he started this independent film production company called Blair Motion Pictures. And he wanted to make sort of industrial films, educational films, et cetera. And he did a few. He did one about called All About Ice Cream, which was about this ice cream factory. His first one was called To Catch a Whale, which was about whalers off the coast, off the Atlantic coast. And it was actually a disaster. He was seasick the whole time and didn't really ever do much. But he realized that the rights to film the NFL championship game were bid on every year. And that this was in 1962, and that the previous year's rights were won for the figures kind of vary depending on who you ask, but I think the dominant figure is $1,500. And he thought this would be really cool because he liked football a lot, liked making movies, and he would actually, a lot of his movies would be of Steve, his son, playing football, playing Pee Wee football. And so he placed a bid on the rights, and this was before football was as popular as it is now, and obviously filming rights are less costly than television because it's non-live, etc. But nevertheless, he doubled the amount of the previous year's bid. And so when the league office got this bid, they thought it was kind of strange. They'd never heard of this guy. He didn't really have any experience to speak of on his resume, etc. But they were intrigued because it was a pretty sizable bid. So he had a meeting with Pete Rozelle. They had like three or four martinis at lunch or something like that. And Sable, remember, is the salesman. And so he kind of sold Rozelle on this idea of being able to represent the league in a pretty dramatic way. And Rozelle basically decided, all right, let's give this guy a chance. Because, you know, if it didn't work out, it really wouldn't be that big of a deal for him anyhow. And that's kind of how he started making the films of the NFL championship. He won the rights to the next 2 years. The films became increasingly popular, and he kind of realized that as these films gained popularity, you know, somebody was gonna decide, wow, well, we can drive up the price of the bid higher than this Sable guy can afford and get the rights and get the contract. So he said, hey, NFL, why don't you bring us in-house? You buy us, and we'll make all of your films. And the owners voted to acquire Blair Motion Pictures and turn it into NFL Films, and they've had cameras at every NFL game since.
And what year was that?
They acquired them in 64.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned Steve Sable, who is also quite quotable. And so, what was his role in the development of NFL films?
Well, his dad was more an entrepreneur, and Steve was more the kind of artistic visionary. The earliest NFL films productions were actually pretty straightforward. They were dramatic, they were exciting in certain ways, but they were not too far from the highlight films that you might see as part of a newsreel package in the late 50s and early 60s. And what Steve Sable brought to the table was a kind of coherent aesthetic vision that tried to bring out the romance of the game and really tried to treat it in a cinematic way, or at least that was his goal. And so one of the things that he did, and when this company started, he was just in college, he was pretty young, but he developed scripts that were kind of what he would describe as a kind of epic poetry or a variation of epic poetry. He wound up, in combination with his dad, hiring John Facenda, who who we now know as the Voice of God. And they hired people to do scores that were more like movie scores. In particular, this guy named Sam Spence started using montage editing, reverse angle replays, ground level slow motion, which was a big one, telephoto lenses, et cetera, all these kinds of techniques to really try to represent football as a cinematic and kind of visceral experience that, in Steve Sable's words, would give the viewer goosebumps. That was kind of one of his main goals.
And they were quite explicit in their references to particular films, correct?
Yeah, one of their sort of their urtext, I guess, or sort of their foundational film was this production called they call it Pro Football, and it's kind of an introduction to the league. And Steve Sable called it, he says that other people refer to it as the Citizen Kane of football movies, and that was the film that kind of combined all of their dominant conventions, the ones that I just mentioned. And beyond that, in interviews, Steve Sable would often reference visual art. He would often reference writers, other films, and kind of suggest that his craft was rooted in these recognizable artistic traditions. And that was true, I think, to an extent, but it was also a strategic move on his part. And as you know, sports media is a stereotypically lowbrow endeavor. You know, it's part of everyday life. It's not something that we expect to be particularly creative or enriching or thought-provoking. And Steve Sable wanted his films and wanted NFL films productions to be thought of differently. He wanted them to be considered art. And so he worked really hard, not only on the production side of things, to make these things look interesting and exciting, but also kind of on the marketing side, to situate them as artworks. And he himself was very much, he very much considered himself to be an artist. He was an art major at Colorado College. He produced original artworks throughout his career. If you go to NFL Films headquarters now, you walk around the hallways, it's the hallways are lined in addition with, you know, images from football history with Steve Sable's artworks, collages, boxes, really interesting stuff. So he worked really hard to suggest that he was an artist and that NFL Films was in the business of producing art and that football was the subject, just like Monet does Lily, you know.
Yeah, so something that struck me in reading the book, particularly that opening chapter where you introduce Ed and Steve Sable, is that, you know, you mentioned that a lot of sports media is lowbrow, but these two guys were really Renaissance men. They had this leaning toward drama, literature, art, and this comes out in terms of what they want to do with NFL films.
Yeah, they really were. And I think that had a lot to do with, you know, how they developed these practices, how they marketed these practices, and how they reached out to different types of audiences, et cetera. Now they were, you know, they were Renaissance men and they were very much kind of schooled in artistic traditions, but they were also businessmen too. And they wanted to attract a broad audience. And amid Steve Sable's references to Monet and Picasso and, you know, later Kurosawa, he would also say things like, well, it's just football, you know, football is a game, football is fun, football is something that we should be able to enjoy while we're sitting down having a beer, etc.
And so one line that you have, he says, is the fate of the universe is not at stake.
The fate of the universe is not at stake. He would also say things like, we're the balloon and we're the pin. We blow it up and then we can kind of explode it. And he was talking about that specifically in reference to the Follies films, which kind of poked fun at the league. And so he wasn't just trying to be highbrow, but he was trying to appeal to maybe a broader audience than might have stereotypically been interested in football. So it was strategic in several ways, right? Both trying to gain that credibility for himself and for his company, but also trying to expand the league's audience. And you know, I think that it seems like they were pretty successful to that end.
Yeah, you mentioned the Football Follies films that they produced. I believe so. This would have been in the mid to late 60s. And this is something I've seen many times. You know, football fans of my generation have seen this many times. But you point out in the book that this was pretty unusual in the genre of sports films to have a film about the mistakes and gaffes that players make.
Yeah, and it was also kind of unusual coming from a league outfit, and the league was pretty hesitant to embrace these Follies films because they were kind of poking fun at gaffes and mistakes and whatnot. And Steve Sable decided, well, let's do a test screening, or can we do a test screening? And they did one for the Eagles because their headquarters is initially in Philadelphia, then moved to South Jersey right down the road. And the players loved it. They thought it was hilarious. And so they wound up doing the Football Follies, and it wound up being their highest-selling production ever. And maybe more importantly, kind of set the stage for an entire genre of not just sports media, but popular media in general. I mean, you could probably trace America's Funniest videos back to the Football Follies to a certain degree. And an interesting thing kind of along the line of what we were talking about earlier with building this aesthetic credibility or referencing art, the Follies title card had a picture of Johnny Unitas, and then it had this sort of comic squeaky marker effect that appeared and drew a mustache on him, kind of similar to Marcel Duchamp's treatment of the Mona Lisa. So you still get that kind of subtle reference to the art world mixed in with the Follies film too.
Travis, can you tell us about how NFL films would shoot games? I found this to be really interesting in terms of the positioning of the photographers, the instructions that they had, and then how the films are assembled.
Yeah, sure. Well, basically they would have three camera positions, three basic camera positions that they would occupy. And sometimes they would only have two cameras at a game. Sometimes they would, you know, Super Bowl, they have 10 or 15. Now they're, you know, who knows how many cameras they have at a game. But the three positions were the tree, the mole, and the weasel, which is what they would call them. And the tree was sort of the standard up in the stands at the 50-yard line for the panoramic view. And that was to make sure they got every play, right? They didn't miss any play. And if for some reason the person on the sideline didn't get a good shot, then they would be able to go to that tree shot if they needed, you know, if it was a great touchdown pass or something like that. Now the mole was on the sideline doing some of mostly the ground level stuff. So when you see that kind of ground level slow motion, or when you see the close-ups of the hands lining up at the line of scrimmage, you know, those were done by the sideline cameras. The weasel was someone with obviously a handheld camera who would go through the stands on the sideline and get all of the candid material, the stuff that kind of surrounds the game. So you'll have these shots or cuts to fans screaming or yelling, or coaches screaming at the refs. Some really famous shots of folks like Hank Stram and Marv Levy come to mind, Vince Lombardi, et cetera. So those are the three basic camera positions. And once they shoot all the film, they take it back to NFL Films, which actually is a fully functioning production facility. They don't just you know, assemble stuff, they process the film, et cetera, it goes from film to finished product, all within that building. They process the film. Some people go through the game film and sort of clip the portions of it that they think might be usable. And then the producers assemble the films for whatever kind of program they might be doing, whether it's a weekly highlight show or a season highlight film for a particular team or whatever. So that's kind of the basic process that goes into filming, and then kind of bringing the film back to NFL Films for use in a production.
And one thing I found interesting when you were describing how the films are made, that you know, one shot, those people who've seen an NFL Films highlight film, one shot that we always associate with it is the tight shot on the football spiraling through the air, this long pass. And something that you bring out, which I don't, you know, make sense when you point it out, is how difficult this would be for a photographer.
Yeah, the ever quotable Steve Sable described it as trying to juggle while surfing, because you have to keep the ball tight in the frame while adjusting for focus and, you know, following its flight through the air. So it's a very difficult task just at the sort of technical level for camera operators to accomplish. And it became kind of a signature of NFL Films, right? Kind of the beauty of football, with this single sphere flying through the air in slow motion, probably backed by, you know, a soaring orchestral swell. And it became this real kind of signature shot that NFL Films uses to showcase the league's gracefulness and beauty.
Travis, a few weeks ago, I interviewed Brett Hutchins and David Rowe about their book on sports and media. And one thing they pointed out is in the book is a big part of the attraction of sports for broadcasters, for networks, is that the audience really has to be there. They have to be there live. They watch the event once. So it's not like a movie or a show that you can record, you can skip past the commercials or download and watch later. But the productions of NFL Films were unique in terms of looking at sports media, in that you could show them over and over again. And I would say, for one, and friends of my generation, we watched them over and over again. I mean, we memorized the lines that were spoken in these highlight films.
Yeah, that's a great point. NFL Films might be something of an exception in that regard. And I think the reason they are an exception, to a degree, things have kind of changed since they started. But the reason they are sort of kind of an exception is because of that sort of cinematic quality that they try to establish with their films. They try to make them something that's not just dependent on what's happening on the field. They try to make them something more. And in fact, that's the whole point of NFL Films, is to mythologize these events and to make them seem more dramatic, more exciting, more beautiful, more important than they actually are. And a function of that, or a consequence of that, is that there are these things that can kind of stand alone as entertaining. Now, the flip side of that is that NFL Films was creating a lot of these productions, or sort of heyday, if you will, was partly before the popularization of cable TV. Right. And so a lot of their highlight films were things that people would see on maybe a Wednesday. They would come out, they'd be referencing games that were played on Sunday. And people hadn't really seen much in the way of highlights of these games, aside from maybe a really short snippet on the evening news, etc. And so they did have this kind of value in that regard. And what happened later on, when cable TV sort of took off, is you're getting these highlights produced immediately after the game. And so by Wednesday, or even Monday, you've already seen these highlights again and again and again. And so their value, even though NFL Films is really spicing them up, is diminished. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's something to be said for Hutchins and Rowe's point there. But I do think that NFL Films is kind of an exception. And the you know, their programs that they do yearly, like Road to the Super Bowl, et cetera, I think they do hold up. Even though we know exactly what's going on, we're still going to watch that because we want to know how NFL Films represented it. We want to see it through that particular style. And so I think their aesthetic conventions have kind of helped them to ward off liveness as a kind of be-all and end-all of sports media.
Mm-hmm. And following up on that, something you discuss is how NFL Films helped promote professional football by making the NFL into a year-round event. So these highlight films would be shown around the country. I remember watching them in you know, church basements or for athletics banquets or things like that in March. And funny, this helped to, your point was, this helped to build the popularity of the NFL.
Yeah, and this was, I mean, the NFL is now a 12-month-a-year sport, no doubt about it. I was watching the draft. I mean, I was watching the draft for this weekend or parts of it, and it's ridiculous. This is something that people have been anticipating. The draft, it has nothing to do with the season. Well, I guess it sort of does in as much as some players will end up playing in it, but this thing that happens in April or May is now this kind of event that people anticipate. And NFL Films, before all these things became these kinds of spectacles that traverse the entire year, NFL Films was creating kind of these reminders that football is exciting. And they would show productions during the summer. And actually, they would adjust the kind of productions that they would show during the summer to stuff that wasn't just dependent on the season. So they would show these kind of human interest pieces during the summer that would show what players did during the off season, that showed players' lives away from football. One of my favorites is this one called The New Breed, and it's about sort of players' relation or certain younger players who had a relationship to kind of the 60s counterculture, and it's about players with longer hair, players who like to dress slightly differently, who are a little bit more, along the lines of kind of the counterculture, the hippie culture at the time. And it was just sort of a profile piece, but it also kind of introduced people and introduced fans to these players, and created some kind of connection or relatability to these players. And maybe provided an incentive to watch them the following season. There was, in The New Breed, there was this linebacker at the time, he was for the Eagles. He was actually Steve Sable's roommate for a while, named Tim Rossovich, and he was making driftwood candles on the beach and walking around and talking about like these sort of trippy dreams he would have and whatnot. It was just a really interesting thing to have at that time. And in doing so, or in creating these profiles, it was also trying to broaden the league's audience, right? And to remind people that football is going on. It's going to be starting in a few months. Right?
And at the same time, the narrative of NFL Films was to connect football to American culture.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in this case, you could argue that, you know, by stressing these players' relationship to the counterculture, it was courting younger fans or courting a different type of younger fans. And it's interesting, too. So with the Rossovich film, where they're talking about how he has this kind of different perspective and kind of open-minded, long hair, has the wearing the bell bottoms and the tie-dye and all that kind of stuff, it also really stressed that even though he looks different, he still has the same kind of desire, this same kind of discipline, this same love for the game. So while it might show somebody who is a little bit different, they would always kind of recuperate these people within the framework of this mythology, right? That football is hard work. Football is kind of discipline and teamwork and all of these things that we associate with the game or that they want us to associate with the game and the league.
Travis, so something that's discussed now in connection with not only the NFL, but with football at all levels in the U.S. is the violence of the game and the cost of violence. And I want to talk about how NFL Films presented violence.
Well, to not beat around the bush, I mean, they glorified it. There were films that they made called The Headcracker Suite. There were films that they made called Bell Ringers. I mean, some really problematic representations of violence in football that no doubt celebrated this these kinds of activities that we now know are incredibly dangerous. And this happened up through the 90s. There was a film they did called Crunch Course, Strike Force, Moment of Impact. All this stuff that we see today, and we're like, whoa, you can't do that. And so I think that there is a degree of kind of responsibility that NFL Films has for contributing to this celebration of violence that we now know is very dangerous and even life-threatening. But I think there's also a sense that NFL Films is a kind of subsidiary that's responsible for glorifying the league. They aren't responsible necessarily for researching the impact of concussions. That's something that, to my mind, falls on the league's shoulders. And I think that the league primarily had a responsibility to step in, especially if they did have knowledge of these long-term effects of concussions, which, you know, if you've read certain things circulating about that, particularly League of Denial, you know, we get the impression that they did. You know, they had a responsibility to step in and say, hey, you can't do this anymore. But yeah, NFL Films definitely participated in that sensibility that the violence of pro football is something that we should celebrate and cherish, and that even something like getting your bell rung is kind of a mark of toughness, or getting your bell rung and being able to go back in the game, etc. So they definitely played a role in that.
Continuing with that, I want to ask how NFL Films dealt with other problems facing professional football. So knowing that you're a fan of the work
directly.
Okay. I was going to say, I know that you're a fan of the work of Michael Oriard, and he lays out
absolutely
clearly the problems with the league. So is this something that they completely skirted?
You know, it would be inaccurate to say they completely skirted it, but their job is to sell the league. Right, their job is to make the league look good. Their job is to make the league look romantic, to attract a broad audience, and so they would avoid most problems. O.J. Simpson doesn't come up unless you're talking about a running back from the 1970s who played on the Buffalo Bills. They've had to kind of adjust a little bit, along with the rise of the NFL Network, which is positioning itself as a news outlet, even though the idea of having a news outlet that's owned by the very organization it covers is a little bit absurd, maybe a lot absurd. But you're not going to hear about that kind of stuff. I mean, they avoided dirty hits, right? Even though they would celebrate these fair or legal hits that were probably more damaging ultimately. But yeah, they would stay away from the controversies. You're not going to see an investigation of the Michael Vick situation or the Ben Roethlisberger situation or Ray Caruth situation produced by an NFL Films program. They're going to be represented solely as players, and likely their presence is going to be minimized when they are facing these kinds of things. Now, if somebody gets into hot water and later kind of recuperates their image and later becomes someone who is kind of quote-unquote rehabilitated, then they might use that as the basis for kind of a inspirational segment. But for the most part, they're promoting the league. They're celebrating the league. And that's what makes them kind of interesting, right? Is because they make these kinds of myths that a lot of people or that folks oftentimes treat as reality. And I think it's important that we kind of push against that and that we sort of recognize that NFL Films does some really interesting stuff. Does some really entertaining stuff, but also that their job ultimately is to help the NFL sell the league, right? And help the NFL create a positive image for the league. And that's something that we need to be, I think, you know, pretty critical of.
So as you mentioned earlier, Travis, professional football has become almost omnipresent in contemporary sports media, thinking of with the proliferation of cable television, sports television, and the NFL is always there 12 months a year. So does NFL film still have a place in American sports media?
It does have a place, but it's changed. NFL films is sort of signature programs have kind of taken a back seat within the National Football League's media operations, which have expanded since the development of the NFL Network. And you're going to see more kind of news-driven stuff, so injury reports, speculations on the draft, updates on trades, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's principally what the NFL Network emphasizes. Now, NFL film stuff is still produced. They still do highlights for every team. They still do, you know, certain types of programs. They produce Turning Point, for instance. And they still do those kinds of things, but they oftentimes don't resemble the kind of classic aesthetic that made them so iconic. That's kind of taken a back seat to the league's efforts to keep up with other media outlets like ESPN. And the stuff that they do in the more traditional format is oftentimes relegated to less popular time slots, etc. It's kind of niche now. It's almost like the History Channel within the NFL Network or something along those lines. But that's not to say that NFL Films, the company has dissolved, but a lot of their operations are now functioning in the service of the NFL Network, which is an organization that has different kind of aesthetic and promotional goals. And the irony of that is that NFL Films kind of laid the foundation for something like the NFL Network and even to a degree, you know, cable television, sports in general, to emerge. And now it's kind of more or less, or to a degree, become kind of a victim of its own success, right? Mm-hmm. It's not as necessary to this media infrastructure that it helped to create. Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, Travis, and talking as you're talking about the diminished role of NFL films, one of the things that I really appreciate, and especially after reading your book, that NFL films did, is as a its role as a shaper of memory for fans. And mm-hmm. you know, so when I was growing up watching NFL films, something it gave me was a sense of the league's past. And the great players who, you know, played decades before, you know, before I was watching professional football. And is that something that's going to be lost, that role of NFL films as the shaper of memory as its role becomes diminished and as the league entrusts its image making to NFL Network and to its connections with ESPN and other networks?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would hesitate to say that the sense of history is going to be lost. And I think that history that it produces is interesting. But it's also important to remember that it was being used strategically. I don't know if the league was showing this Lombardi or Jim Brown footage just for the sake of remembering its past, but creating, again, this mythology that would help us to see the NFL as kind of a storied, important institution. And I wonder sometimes, I've thought about this question too, if now that mythology is so firmly in place, if they really see the need to focus in on it. Mm-hmm. And maybe they find it more lucrative or easy or inexpensive maybe to focus on the immediate. But it's fascinating, you know, and if you think about the history of sports, sort of the visual history of sports from the last 50 years or so, these images are so prominent, you know, Lombardi, Jim Brown, Johnny Unitas. And it's not just because football is important to America, because it obviously is, But it's because this footage exists, right? We didn't have anybody, you know, filming Roberto Clemente, you know, in 16 millimeter rounding the bases. I mean, it happened from time to time, but not in the way that NFL films did it. Or, another example, you don't have footage of Bill Russell, you know, with sweat sort of dripping down his brow in slow motion color in the same way that you do with the NFL stuff. So this history is valuable, I think, in a way, but it also creates kind of is designed to create a bit of a skewed view of what sports mean in America and why they're important and who they're important to, et cetera.
And that's a big part of your argument, is that the rise of the NFL to become the United States' most popular sport comes from these images and these productions from NFL films.
Yeah, in part. You know, I mean, it was part of a bigger effort. And Pete Rozelle is very much responsible for this. He was a really marketing and PR savvy guy. But NFL films was a huge part of that. They were also doing things like creating board games for kids and doing charity work like they do now, and all these kinds of things to cultivate an image, a favorable and dramatic image. And NFL Films is, you know, arguably the most prominent piece in that larger effort. And if you look at all the stuff the NFL is doing today, as far as its marketing activities, as far as its kind of charitable and PR activities, you know, I think you can trace a lot of that to NFL Films. It's not entirely responsible for it, but it played a pretty important role in that effort.
Well, Travis, we're almost out of time, so I'll ask you what you're working on now. What's your new project?
I'm writing a book on ESPN right now. It actually kind of grows out of a lot of the ideas that I was working with NFL Films. And the whole thing that I'm looking at with this project is how ESPN builds a sense of authority and credibility within sports media, how it convinces people of its worldwide leader in sports status, through engaging practices that are stereotypically viewed as more sophisticated or refined than run-of-the-mill sports media. So I'm looking at how it sponsors film festivals, creates documentaries, publishes books, hires people like Hunter S. Thompson, sponsors sports writing awards, all these kinds of things that we might imagine as being maybe more refined than your typical sports media, and how it uses that to create authority, expand its reach, compete for market share. So it's kind of the relationship between ESPN's industrial and commercial activities and its cultural meaning.
Well, Travis, very good.
And I'm excited to write for the All-Rounder that you're running.
Yeah, it will be great to have you. I look forward to it, too. It'll be great to have you writing for it. So, yeah, for those listeners, this is we're branching out of podcasting and moving into an online site that will feature a lot of the guests that have been on the podcast in the last few years, and Travis will be one of them. And I look forward to it.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun, and we appreciate you starting that thing up, Bruce.
You've been listening to an interview with Travis Vogan about his book, Keepers of the Flame, NFL Films and the Rise of Sports Media, published in 2014 by the University of Illinois Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from philosophy to popular music. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.
Mm-hmm.